You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Janelle Martin. We talk about addiction and recovery. Specifically, Janelle shares the journey she went through with one of her children and addiction and how she learned about releasing control and releasing trying to fix her daughter. So I am not a substance use counselor or even an expert in addiction or substance misuse, but I think that it's pretty solid chance that a lot of people listening to this have exposure and experience to people in their life who have gone through this to some degree or another with something or another. And that's because I think that this experience of supporting people and who are in our families and in our extended networks who are struggling with substance use is very common. And at the same time, even though I feel this is a very common experience, I find that it's still something that has enormous social stigma. Let me know if you agree. So that mismatch of things, that seems strange to me. This is not the only place where I see this happen, but it's one of them. But I feel like if supporting our family and friends and coworkers who are going through substance use struggles is a thing that happens a lot and a lot of people, then that sport journey should be more normalized and more supported, and we should not feel like we are ostracized and isolated when we go through it. I seem to have somehow stumbled on top of a soapbox there for a second. Sorry about that. Anyway, are you ready for this interview? Of course you are. Let's do it. Janelle Martin, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here. Are you ready for a chat?
I am. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, this is going to be good. So I start all my interviews asking my guests what part of the world you call home. So where are you today?
I have lived in the north part of Houston, actually a suburb of Houston called Magnolia, Texas, for about 25 years.
Wow. All right. Nice. Very good. So the saying is that laughter is the best medicine. Yes. What is something that you can count on to bring smiles and laughter to your life?
There's two things. One is my dog. He's hilarious. He's a ball of energy. He's a tiny little Maltese. He's 7 pounds, but he has the giant, most giant personality there is. And he's always doing funny things. But also my daughter is hilarious. She is so sarcastic and so that person that says what everyone's thinking, but you normally wouldn't say it. She will say it. And she is hilarious. So both of them, big personalities in a tiny package.
Love it. Oh my gosh. Those are good answers. I love it when people say they're pets. Yes. I think that's true. And I don't even have, like, the only pets that we have are, we don't have any big furry pets in the house, but I rely on the humor of pets through, like, social media. Like, I just, like, people sometimes give the algorithm, you know, a bad rap. They're like, oh, the algorithm feeds me all this stuff I don't want. I'm like, that you've programmed it wrong, because mine feeds me silly cat videos in the middle of the night. And I think that's great.
Great. Yes.
I think that's great. All right. The topic of the day, you suggested a time when you stopped trying to fix your daughter's addiction and focusing on your own healing. And so this is a change that you went through in your life. It sounds to me like a very complex but important story, and I'm happy to hear about it. I'm looking forward to the conversation and learn about it. My first question is about the time frame. When would you say, how long ago was it that you would say that you made this shift?
It's probably been about 6 or 7 years now. My daughter's addiction started when I was clued in. Was 2017. So there, it was a very quick time frame of her becoming both addicted and very in crisis, very much in crisis. And so that started the ball rolling of treatment and all of that stuff. And it was once we got her into treatment and I started to understand the disease that I had no exposure to whatsoever prior to, that's when that shift happened. Was I can't control her. The only thing that I can control is me, and I clearly needed some help and healing on my own. And I needed to be okay, whether she was going to be okay or not. And that is a really hard thing as a parent.
I think that letting go, we'll talk about that more as we go through it. But anytime, I have not had the exact same experience as you, you know, in anything, right? Our lives are different. But anytime I've tried to give up control, it has always been more complicated and harder, and I think especially with kids. Okay, so a part of this story is not your own, it's your daughter's. And I'm going to be respectful of that. This is a story you've told before, so you are good at telling it. So, but without talking about anything personal or overly private, do you want to share with us what kind of addiction substance use you guys were experiencing?
Yeah, well, it started for her with pot, as it does for a lot of people, and it just grew into anything she could get her hands on. She really preferred cocaine and Molly, but she would use whatever was available to her. And as a teen, you can find it, but you get what you get. So,
Okay.
she first, well, she used LSD. I mean, there's quite a few different drugs that she just wasn't indiscriminate about it.
All right, interesting. That's not actually, you know, I'm not an expert, so if I was to have predicted what the answer was, I would have not expected that it would have been a mixed bag, and so I'm glad I asked. So you shared that this shift of that you went through impacted your relationship with your daughter, and also your career path. And so before we dig in to what you did and those kind of things, I wanted to take a minute and figure out, like, learn a little bit about what your guys' life was like before all of this happened. Like, what was your relationship with her like? What was your career like? Tell us what life was like before. If this started when she was 17, like, back it up to when she was 10 or 12.
Yeah, that's a good portion of what people want to know is like, how did this happen? And that is the first few chapters of the book. I divorced her dad when she was three. It was final when she was four, so that she is from a broken home. And unfortunately, her dad, once I remarried when she was about eight. But once that happened, her dad, her biological dad, sort of had it out for me, let's say, and used the kids to try to get to me and ruin my life. So that was a major contributing factor to why she chose what she chose. But she also has an older brother, and so both kids were being affected by the things he was telling them and what he was doing to try to get back at me. And but outside of that, we're very typical middle class family. We went to church every weekend, and the kids went to Sunday school and youth group and, did all the normal things. Went to school, played sports. She was an athlete and a good one. And from the outside, I think we look like any other typical family. We aren't wealthy, but we're not poor either. We live in a decent neighborhood and we have a decent, modest size house and all of the things. And that was part of one of the first reasons we wanted to tell her story is because it was really important for her to tell people or to impress upon people that this can happen to anyone. It doesn't matter where you come from, it still happens. Because generally she had a good upbringing, except for the things that her dad was doing. And unfortunately, over time, her dad's antics played out such that her big brother believed dad, and she was caught in the middle of not feeling like she was allowed to engage with mom and stepdad because dad and brother were mad at her, and she was just being pulled apart. And to escape all of that, she went to a party. Well, I don't even know when. I think it may be in the book, but I was unaware of it at the time. But she tried marijuana, and it took all of those horrible feelings of sadness and depression and wanting to kill herself away. And she was hooked as soon as that happened. And she wanted more of that because she didn't want to feel all of the horrible things that she'd been feeling. And I didn't know the depth of her pain at the time. I knew what was going on. I felt powerless to stop it because I couldn't stop my kids from having anything to do with their dad. That just made things worse if I tried to put limits or do anything like that. So I was really powerless in the situation, and there was always a lot of tension in our home. And I felt very much like the peacekeeper. I tried to keep everybody happy. I stayed in the middle of everything just to kind of try to dampen that, but it never worked very well, I don't think. And ultimately, my son ended up leaving after graduation, and he has been estranged from us for 8 years now. And she lost her big brother, who was her person up to that point. She turned to drugs, and I didn't know drugs were an option. So it blindsided me like nothing has else ever in my life.
Okay, so let me recap that and sort of make sure that I'm understanding what things were like. So I would say you guys had a complex relationship
Very.
and that there was stress and conflict as a result of the severing of the relationship, the marital relationship with your ex-husband. It sounds like you were sharing custody and co-parenting with your ex. Is that right? And then it was high conflict, and dramatic, and weaponization of the relationships between you and your children, and estrangement, between the older son and other parts of the family. That's a very complex dynamic. So, but you remarried, and so, and that also means that kids that are going back and forth between two houses, it is more complicated for all of the adults to know what the kids are doing. We also, my husband was married before, so my oldest kids are my stepkids, and there's just more adults, there's more pieces, there's more moving pieces. Like, so if you grow up and you don't have a house where there's more than one, where it's divided, even then you probably played these games where it's like, all right, you go to one house and you're like, okay, we're going to tell everybody we're at the other house, but you're really at a third house. But that's kind of the constant state when you've got kids that have two houses and they're going back and forth. It's like, all right, where is everybody on this day and what's happening? And who. It's a lot of moving parts for adolescents, and so did I summarize that in kind of a good way? But there was love. There was love. Everybody was doing their best to love each other, and the people are good. All right. So that's very so. But it was hard. She was a teenager. It was a complex relationship for a lot of reasons, and you were aware. It's one of these things. Teenagers are tough little nuggets, right? Tough little nuggets. I don't know about you, but I actually thought I was a delight when I was a teenager. Like, I look back at myself, but then when I began living with teenagers and seeing what it was like, it was like a mirror on what I had been like, and I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe I wasn't. Maybe I wasn't as easy to get along as I thought I was. So, the impact of substance use and recreational drug use is like this weird thing in modern society, right? Like, everybody knows about it. Everybody knows people who have lived through it. We see it in TV, we see it in movies, all of these things. But at the same time, and I'm not an expert on this topic, this is just me anecdotally speaking, it does really still seem like there is an enormous social stigma and social price to pay for the people who are living through it. With their children and their spouses and whoever, parents, all of those things. You say that you stopped trying to fix it. And so my first question that I want to talk about is, like, what do you mean when you say fix it? Like, what were you trying to do when you were trying to fix it that like you that eventually you decided wasn't working?
First tried begging her to stop, and trying to enforce the boundary of you cannot use drugs and live in our home. I won't have that. And then of course the lies, I'll stop, I'll do all these things. And she was never a good liar unless she was under the influence. Then it was like she could say anything, and I never really knew whether she was telling the truth or not. I always had a feeling something was always off, but like I couldn't put my finger on it a lot of times. But the begging, the grounding, all of the things that parents try to do when your kid is doing something, and you don't believe, at least I did not believe that this was a problem. I believed that this was something that all kids did. It was a phase. It was She was experimenting. That's what all my friends, family said, oh, this is normal. It didn't feel normal to me, and it wasn't okay with me, regardless. If it was normal, I didn't like it. But she very quickly, it affected her life in such dramatic ways that it couldn't be ignored. Like she was dressing in dark, baggy clothing all the time. She wasn't combing her hair. I don't even know if she was washing her hair at certain points. She would be just sort of hiding all the time. If she was home, she was in a room. That was it. Like we didn't hardly see her. She was staying out late, saying she was working, and she did have a job, so it was hard to tell. She never had any money, and she was working, so she should have had some money, but there was never any money there. Just school, not getting good grades, just not, she didn't care about anything. She quit playing the sport that she loved. She just, it was like she was disappearing really in front of me. And I still didn't really clue in that this was drug addiction. I really just knew that she must not be feeling good, but she would act like she was okay when I would ask her, so that we never really got to have any serious conversations about what was going on with her. And I was in denial. I would never have said, oh, it's drugs. I would never have said that. But I did catch her a couple of times using, and that second time was the middle of her senior year, and she was 17. And my line in the sand was, you have to stop or you can't live here. I had said it before and I meant it. And she said she wasn't going to stop. I mean, she was honest at that point. She's like, I'm not going to stop. And I really didn't know what to do other than I dialed the phone and to her dad and put the phone on the bed and said, this is what's going on. And she had a trip to go see him. He lived out of state in Arizona, and she had a trip already planned because it was New Year's. It was right after Christmas this happened. And I said, when she gets on the plane, she's taking as much stuff as she can get with her, take with her, because she's not coming home. And she had no reaction to that whatsoever. So I basically kicked her out, sent her to the person who worked so hard to turn her against me to begin with, and had to hope and pray that getting her into maybe a new life somewhere else was going to be with different people, different friends, get her away from these bad influences here. Maybe that was going to fix it, and I could just, hope that she graduated high school and do everything I could to help her, succeed and move on with her life. But that quickly spiraled out of control when she moved to live with her dad. And within 3 months, she had cut all her hair off. She had hair down to her waist her whole life, and she basically shaved her head. And she was defying him. She was so defiant with him, like this girl that I've never ever seen before. And so my only solution was to get her into treatment because we needed her to get better, and I didn't know what to do with her. And so we got her into treatment. And luckily, this treatment center that we found, and it was really a God thing that I even found it. There's not a lot of options for kids who are teens out there. And this one happened to be about 2.5 hours from where she was staying with her dad, so it was semi-convenient. But they had parent meetings there, and they were every Thursday night. And I lived in Texas, so I didn't get to go to any of those. And initially, I went to Al-Anon. I hated Al-Anon. I didn't know what that was about. I felt so out of place and so uncomfortable. And finally, the treatment center put me in touch with some other parents in the program who had kids in the program, and they started to help me understand bit by bit what was going on, and turned me on to the parent meetings, and would let me call in and be on
Okay.
speakerphone so I could listen. And those meetings changed my life. But the biggest thing that made me pivot from, I was always focused on my daughter. This is all about her. How do we help her? What's going to help her? What do I need to do? And they encouraged very much that parents get a sponsor and work through the 12 steps with a sponsor. And I didn't know anything about the 12 steps, but I thought if this is what my daughter's learning, I would like to learn this too, because then maybe I can have some good conversations with her and I can understand what's going on. And so I did. I got a sponsor and I started working through the 12 steps. And I don't know why the 12 steps are not taught in schools from the age of elementary on up, because the 12 steps isn't really all about addiction. It is a way of life. And I just couldn't believe how life-changing that experience was. I was still worried about my daughter, but there was stuff happening in me that was changing because I went through that and did that work and had to really take a good hard look at myself. And that is not something that most of us like doing, but
No, they don't. I think you answered your question, like about why people don't like to do the work. So you mentioned, so all right, so there was a lot in there, and I'm going to recap it because it is a big story. So you guys live in Texas. You and your daughter are really struggling, having control battles. You knew that her behaviors were causing problems, and you were just trying to get her to shift. And that's what was trying to fix it. It's like, hey, this is a problem. Just listen to me and stop doing this. And it hit a point, which I would call a line in the sand. Like it would fall under crisis. Like you're at the end of the rope. This is it. If you're not going to do this, you got to go live with your dad, right? So she goes. Unfortunately, mixing up her life and giving her a boundary doesn't cause her to change her self-destructive behavior. She continues to act out and spiral. Are you talking to your ex as this is going through? You're both like trying to deal with this as a dis even through the distance.
To his chagrin, I would call every week to have a weekly talk with him about what was going on with her and how they were doing. And I was always told everything was fine.
Okay, so he was not admitting that there was a problem at that point. Okay.
Oh, and neither was she.
Okay, and did he have to come around to, when it came time to put her in her program, was he aware that things were out of control?
Yes, because it spiraled so badly. The way that I found out was he called me crying.
Okay. All right. So all
Confess.
hands on deck at this point.
Yes.
Find a residential program,
Yeah.
residential treatment program. And they suggest that you go to Al-Anon, which is one of the 12-step programs.
Yes.
So most people have heard of AA. Al-Anon is I think
Yes.
the family program. So it's people who have substance use, whether it's narcotics or alcohol, in their family. So a spouse, a daughter, a mom, any of those things. And there's so many specialty groups that fall under these self-support groups, and some people love them and they have life-changing experiences. Other people really struggle with the concepts of the 12-step program and the structure and the group, and I'm not here to judge or evaluate anybody. But there are some things I will say as someone who's an outsider, there are several elements of the 12 steps which you find in so many personal development programs. One of which is you'll tell me if I get it close, the self inventory. They call it like doing a self inventory, which is self examination and being honest with yourself about the things that you're not good at. And nobody likes to do that, whether you call it coaching or entrepreneurship or a SWOT analysis. Like that is not a fun thing for people to do. So good for you for going through that. Is this where the 12-step and Al-Anon and the parent meetings, is this where you are introduced to the idea, and the path of giving up control and working on your own healing?
Yes, absolutely. Because, I don't have control over anyone else. Even though my daughter was still at that time, she was considered a minor. She was still 17. She has a mind of her own and a life of her own to live. And whatever she chose to do with it is her choice. I can't force her to do anything. And I didn't know. We had no idea if this treatment was going to work or help her, but I had to figure out a way that I could let go and be okay regardless. And they preached that. And I know, like, it is very hard to even hear that as a parent, that I'm supposed to be okay if my kid's not okay. But it's true, because we all have purpose in this life, and our purpose doesn't depend on if our kid is okay or not. So,
Yes, that's a tough one, right? Because we do judge each other as adults, and or we feel judgment from other parents. Like, so if your kid is the one that's getting good grades at school, people are kind to you. And when your kid is not high performing, people will people
you did.
right. You know, like, hey, you should make sure they do their homework. I'm like, okay, well, if it was my homework, I would. All right, so this is a good place to take a pause and invite the audience into the conversation. I'm talking to Janelle Martin about the transformation that she experienced during a time when a family member was struggling with addiction and recovery. So if you're listening or watching the show, head over to social media. If you don't already follow the show on social media, the links are in the show notes. And there's a discussion question. So you can jump in and be a part of the conversation. I'll be there in the comments. Maybe Janelle will stop in too. Other people in the imperfect adulting community will be there. It's fun. All right. So now back to the conversation. We were talking about your healing journey and how you found your way to that, which was as it's like a side effect of your daughter going through her own treatment program, right? So what did healing look like for you? Because now we're talking about you going through this. And then how did that turn out to impact your relationship with your daughter?
Oh my gosh, it was profound, actually. So I started to go visit her in Arizona. Her program was a 2 to 2.5 year program. So we,
Wow,
I
2 years.
yes, we thought for sure she was going to be there for the long term. And I was totally okay with that. But I'm not okay with not seeing her and not spending time with
I've
her.
never even heard of a 2-year program. You
I
knew from
know.
the get-go that it was a 2-year residential program. That is amazing. Oh my gosh.
Well, she did the residential portion, and that was 6 weeks. And then she did an outpatient portion, which is 8 weeks, and then a 6 months of aftercare. And then the rest of the time, they don't live in the program, but they are still part of it, and they still have meetings and events and all the things that they get to participate in. So it's like they're still in it, but they don't sleep in the same house with each other. Some of them do, actually. They have some home, like sober living homes that they are.
Sure, yeah. So, but when you guys found it, they said this is a 2-year program.
Yes, I did.
That is phenomenal. Okay, sorry. I totally sidetracked your answer
The
and I
brain is not perfect.
apologize. I've
Okay.
never, the only thing I've ever heard that's like that is there's like in Massachusetts, there's a place that, like, if you do DBT, like for personality disorder, that's supposed to be a 3-year program, but that's pretty rare too. And so, anyway, okay. So, when you said 2 years, I was like, what? Because what I hear usually as I'm in Florida, it's like, 3 days of inpatient, and then, you know, we hope you'll come back for group therapy.
Yeah, and at the time, I didn't know anything about the whole industry then. So I had to take it in little bits. I know that I heard 2 years, 2.5 years, but I couldn't comprehend that. I really just thought, we'll just start. And I didn't think she was bad enough, even at the time, to do the residential, but that's what they recommended. And Lord knows that was the absolute right thing. I just could not believe that this was where we were.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't. And so I just needed to take it in bits. Okay, we'll do this first part, and then she's probably going to be fine. And then, we'll see what happens later. And then we had to do the next part. Okay, well, we'll see. She's probably going to be fine. And
Okay.
so that was me.
And so I interrupted you. Let me get you back on topic. I apologize. Totally, like, totally. So we were talking about the profound impact it had on your relationship, and you were saying that you started to visit her. And so
Yeah.
that's where we were.
That was the best thing ever, because once I started to look at myself and be able to separate, I think the two of us sort of being separated as well was healing in just its own sense of not living together on the day to day. But I would go visit her, and I would spend a weekend. I did it several times, but and I would take her shopping, and I would do the things, just because I really wanted her not to wear those dirty or drab black baggy clothes all the time. So I bribed her out of those. But We were able to have some conversations that we'd never had before. And we started to put those puzzle pieces together of the things that she had been experiencing that I kind of knew but didn't know. And then I started to fill in the gaps for her because one of her complaints was all of the noise that was going on with her dad and her brother and all of that. I never defended myself. I always kept it my mouth shut. I didn't defend. I didn't attack. I didn't do anything. So she was always confused whether what they were saying was true or whether it wasn't. And so we finally, the door opened to those conversations of this is why I did what I did, and this is why she did what she did, or she would ask questions and I would ask questions. And over that year, I mean, we really changed our relationship and started to relate much less in a mom-daughter sort of role, but more of a I want to understand you and you want to understand me, and we can build something from there. And we had some very profound, hard conversations during that time, but and that's where it all changed.
And why do you think that it was helpful? Why do you think it started with you working on yourself?
Because I had to get myself to a point where I could take responsibility, even though it wasn't my fault that she used drugs. But I mean, there were a lot of things that I maybe coulda, woulda, shoulda. We all say that done differently looking back, you know, or things that I should have seen that I didn't, and things that I just didn't know that maybe I could have asked about or should have asked about. But taking a look at me and just breaking it down to none of us are perfect. I didn't do this all right. She's still my daughter. We've got some things to rebuild. We've got to figure this out. And I love her. I've always loved her. I've loved both of my children. But you can't rebuild a relationship from a standpoint of, I did everything right. You have the problem. So I'm going to let you figure out how to make it right. It doesn't work that way.
Okay, I think that's very clear. Part of it sounds like it's there's a parenting tip that I love, and it is learning to separate the feelings about the person from the behaviors of the person. It's like and so it sounds like there's a little bit of that is a part of this process, both for yourself and for your relationship with your daughter. It's like I will always love you. But sometimes I'm not going to love the things that you do. And that's true when people, they stay out past curfew, little tiny things, they're snarky in a conversation. Also when they make big mistakes, or mistake is the wrong word, but when they do things that really veer off from what we want them to do. And that's, I, and it's not just our kids, right? It can be our friends, our coworkers, and it's not easy. It's not easy. I can explain the method a lot more easily than I can apply it in my own life. So I don't want to pretend that I am some sort of perfect model of this. All right. So we talked a little bit about this right at the beginning, because this is something that is a hallmark of your story, is the work of giving up control of somebody else. I think this is such a hard thing to do. It's such a hard thing to do. Anytime I try and do it, I'm like, why? Why is it so hard? Like in so many ways to actually do it, to be like, yeah, not my circus, not my monkeys. And then I'm in there, like, let me tell these monkeys what they should be doing. And I think that it can be especially hard with our kids, because there is a period of time when they're very small, right? When we do tell them what to do, we're in charge of every part of their, they don't eat if we don't hand them food, right? So I think it's very confusing as adults. So
Right.
what specifically, let's talk about some of the things that you were doing that you were giving up control over. Share with us some of the ways that it was hard, and maybe some of the ways that it positively impacted your life when you were able to release.
Oh my gosh, everything. She didn't want to finish high school. She wanted her car back after
Okay.
she had a residential. That was a big deal. We needed to sort of put her on an allowance so that she could pay for the things that the program was wanting them to pay for. And the expectations that she was going to get out, get a job, finish school, do all the things, because we got to a point, it was pretty early on. We did all those things, but we gave her a car back, but we put it in her name, so we had no liability, and she was
Okay.
able to pay the insurance. Letting go of school, like she'd already had to drop out of school. I'd rather have her sober than relapse over feeling too overwhelmed with school. So
Was
we
that hard?
put that off. She didn't want to go, and it wasn't a battle. I tried to fight it at first, but it quickly was like, do you want her to work on her sobriety, or do you want her to get a
Okay.
degree in high school? Like, is her life more important than school? And that's really what it came down to. And yes, so you have to let that go. You know, I had to let go of just all the things that I wanted for her that weren't happening. She didn't graduate high school with her friends. She didn't get to go to prom. She didn't get to, you know, finish her last year of beach volleyball and go back to nationals. Like, there's so many dreams that we have for our kids, and that controls us into trying to make them do all these things. For my daughter, none of those were happening. And we did try, though, that summer, the first summer that she was there. Once she got out of residential and she had gotten even out of outpatient, her dad and I sat down and said, okay, we're taking away her allowance, and we're requiring her to go to school and get a job. She needed to do all these things. And it was about maybe a week, and I'd gone to the parent meeting over the phone this particular night, and the topic in the meeting was, I don't even remember what they called it, but it was addressing overwhelming your child early in recovery. So at that point, she was probably only 3 months sober. So giving them, expecting too much from them can push them over the edge, back over the edge. They're still early in recovery. There's still a lot of work to do. And all I heard during that meeting was, you can't do this to her. You are overwhelming her. This is too much to put on her right away. And after that meeting, I was in tears and I called her. This isn't even in the book, but I called her and she answered, and I just told her, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry we did this to you. We're not gonna, we don't forget it. Forget all of those things. We just really want to support you in your sobriety. And if you get a job, or whenever you get a job, we'll talk about the allowance and we'll figure this other stuff out. You know, I just want you to know, like, I love you, and all I care about is that you're okay and that you're sober. And she started crying, and she's like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. And it was this whole thing, like, I can't control any of that. Now, it took a really long time for her to do those things,
Yeah.
but it doesn't matter because she's sober. So, I mean, and it wasn't, it was hard. It's hard to be patient as a mom and not control that. But she ended up moving back home even, and then it got even harder. You know, I had to relinquish control probably a million times.
Yeah, so let's talk about one of these because there's layers of this, right? Like, so we focus on like I want you to stay in school, right? And we think that we should be able to say that and that they should want it. But what's behind that is her making a decision about her whole life, right? Like, and there's probably 100 decisions in that one, right? It's like, we're like, you need to go to school. But when we do that, we're removing from her the ability for her to make her own decision of, am I going to go to school? For some kids, it really, like, for some parents, it looks like it, some families, it looks like it works from the outside. I watch it happen. They're like, you need to pick a sport and do it. And the kids seem like they're doing it. I don't know, you know, but other times it's not, it doesn't work. The kids are like, no, I have to make my own decision. And I think that most of us know whether we're talking about something like this or so many other things. We excel at and stick to the things that we decide for ourselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but and it's hard though, right? Because we know we're older than they are. We don't want our kids to make mistakes, or our friends, or our partners, or our parents to make mistakes with big consequences. And so many things High school is still one of those things. It's like, okay, so listen, if you want to get a mortgage, they're going to ask you, if you, they're, this is a checkbox on a form. Like, do you have a diploma? Like, we don't, can you have a life without it? Sure. But there, this is one of those things that, really does make things easier. Like, you
Absolutely.
can't go back and do it again, that is really, so she moved back with you. You're continuing every day to work on this, giving up control, letting her make decisions,
Yes.
even
And she
if you don't agree with them.
no, and she relapsed about a month after being home. And so the biggest thing, probably the example I have of letting go was that when she came to me and told me she had relapsed and that she was leaving, she respected my rule of no drugs in the house and all of that. I let her go. And so many people could not understand that decision. And I really questioned, like, okay, well, what am I going to do? Tie her up and put her in the closet? Like, I don't know how to keep her from this. If this is her choice, this is what she wants to do. And she at that point had almost a year of treatment. So she knew everything she needed to know about drugs and addiction and all the things, recovery. And she's still making this choice. I need to let her figure it out because I can decide I want her to be sober, but clearly that hasn't made a difference. She's still relapsed. She's got to decide that she wants to be sober. And when she decides, she'll be sober. And that was even harder than sending her to her dad's the year prior, letting her walk out, pack up as much as she could. I told her she had to take her dog and leave. And I didn't know where she was for weeks.
Oh my gosh, that does sound really hard. But it is that decision. It's that awareness of, and even if we're, the people listening are in a family where that you don't have substance use or something else, there's probably a version of your kids becoming adults that you will face, because allowing them to make mistakes, allowing them to grow up on their own, allowing them to experience the consequences of their actions and their decisions can be brutal. Brutal, absolutely brutal. But this does sound like it's very, very tough and emotionally really, really hard that you went through. How did you keep your strength and fortitude and your mindset and self-care during some of these hard times where you were releasing control and letting her choose her own path, even if it was looked like it was really grim?
Biggest thing probably is prayer. Second thing is meetings. I went back to that Al-Anon meeting that I hated because I need face-to-face support. I needed to be in a room full of people at that point. I'm still going to parent meetings online or over the phone. I think by that time they had a video component, so they had accommodated me better. But I went to Al-Anon and the support of other people in the same experiencing similar things is probably what kept me sane and going forward throughout the whole experience, but especially during that time. I just needed that so badly. And nobody can tell you, oh, it's going to be okay. She's not going to die. Nobody could tell you that, but they can tell you that, you're going to be okay regardless. And she's got to figure it out.
It probably doesn't feel like it's going to be okay in the
No.
middle of it.
No, it doesn't. It's very terrifying, actually. She had no money, no job, no anything. I don't know how she was surviving.
Oh my goodness. Oh, so she does, is she, so she is alive.
She is, yes.
Okay.
She's
All right.
sober now.
All right.
So.
Okay. So yes, because it is not a foregone conclusion that will be the outcome. So, okay. So one of the themes behind my show and the message that I would shout from the rooftops if I could, if that was a real thing we did, is that very few of the seasons in this adulting experience we have are like clear cut when they start and when they stop. It's more like they begin and then they just kind of go on forever. Now, some of them do, right? Like high school, you start and then it's going to come to an end whether you finish or not. Like that's one that does. This sounds like a ramble, but there like is a point. You've written two books. One of them is about your journey through addiction and recovery with your daughter, right? This the, and that's a, through the journey, right? But my question is this a journey that, in your opinion, is over, or is this something that is now a part of your life, a part of your experience that will continue for you and your family forever and ever?
Yes, it is a journey that will continue forever and ever because recovery is forever. It's not, there's not an end point to it. You don't just, you're not healed, you're not cured, but you just continue to work on recovery. And the experience has changed my life. Like my job, my career, my purpose has all shifted from the experience that we had together and separately going through my daughter's addiction. So, and she works with me today. We own a holistic mental health practice, and we offer natural solutions to brain healing and mental health. And we have a heart for people who have either been on the side of, addicted to drugs, or and the family members of people who are addicted as well. And I host weekly support group meetings for parents of addicted loved ones. And I have done that for 6 years. And every time I think I should probably give that up, I can't, because I still love the support of the parents in the room. And I also love offering maybe a light at the end of the tunnel for some of the new ones that come in and just don't know. They're as clueless as I was 7 years ago, and we take their hand and we help them, find their way a little bit. And I can't let go of that either. So there's been a lot that has changed for me. And there was never a point in time where I thought, oh, my daughter and I are going to work together. That wasn't even on the radar, but helping people became a mission for me. And I've been in practice now for 6 years too. I'm a counselor. I just got my functional medicine doctorate. I just keep learning and growing, and now I'm writing books, and I don't know where it ends, but my daughter came to me 3 years ago and asked if she could work with me, as she was one of my first clients when she was getting sober that second time, and I was able to help her tremendously with her recovery and her cravings and anxiety and lots of other things she was dealing with at the time. So it just kind of came full circle, and it's a dream that I never even had the courage to dream that we would be this close, and when we're best friends and colleagues, and I don't know, it's pretty amazing.
Well, part of that giving up control, right? Like you talked about it, like the having the parent dreams of what our kids will do, right? And I think almost everybody does that, right? Like, so you have kids that come into your life, whether they're stepkids or your own kids or, kids that are down the block, and you immediately cast this vision of them, becoming the president of the United States and getting married and all of these things, right? And it weirdly, giving up control of that and your vision of their future is often the thing that allows space for amazing things to happen, is kind of a crazy thing. And so when you say I could never have dreamed, it's weird because it's like we believe in the power of manifestation and we want to have a clear vision and so on and so forth. But sometimes those clear visions get in the way. And so that's a beautiful, beautiful story. So you touched on this a little bit. I'm going to rephrase it and have you say it again because I think it's an important thing. Because you could have gone through this experience, you could have focused on your daughter, you could have focused on your family, you could have had a profound transformation and never talked about it, never written the book, never come on podcast. Why do you feel that it is supportive and helpful and maybe even important for you and maybe even your daughter to share this story with others?
Initially, it's funny because 5 years ago or so, we both individually had the idea to write this book.
Oh,
Exactly.
really?
Yeah, we did. She came to me and said, I think we should write a book. And I'd already been thinking about it, and we wanted to write it with both perspectives, because I read so many books when it was just in the beginning of all of this, just trying to figure it all out and get answers to things. And I could only find books either written by somebody who was a recovering addict, or the mom or the parent. And I always wanted to know the other side. If it was the parent, I wanted to know what the kid was doing. And if it was the kid who is addicted, I wanted to know what was going on in the family, what was happening. I just needed the full picture. And so that's what we wanted to write. And it was just funny that we had the same dream. And I did start writing it back then, but I didn't know how to publish it and I didn't know what I was going to do with it. So I got about halfway through it and I didn't finish it, but I saved it. And her life, went off in a direction where she's just very busy and she doesn't consider herself a writer. So she just didn't really do that. So, but the big reason that we wanted to do is, I think I said this earlier, is just because we're such a just blandly normal, whatever that is, family. Lots of people come from a product of divorced parents and live in a middle class house and have a middle class income and drive boring cars and, things like that. And it still happened. Like it can look like everything is great from the outside, but you never know what people are dealing with on the inside. And she just is really brave. I would have never told this story if she wasn't willing to tell it because I just think it's more powerful if we both tell it together. And so she was willing and she really has a heart for other people too. And it's really because of that. And I think the more I've worked with clients and the more I've worked with these parents in my parent meetings, we've gotten the opportunity to talk like at some different conferences and things like that. And it's always so well received when we speak together. And she's seen that and I've seen that. And we've been just asked to do more of it. And so the book just seemed like it needed to get finished. And so I did it. And so she didn't write her parts, but I interviewed her for every chapter. And every chapter has her voice in it and her words in it. And that's the one thing that seems to be the most powerful thing from when I hear from readers is just getting both perspectives together just makes the book so much more powerful.
Yeah, because even though it was happening at the same time, they're very different.
Very.
Very different. I mean, even if you were to do, I mean, this has always amazed me. This is one of the crazy things about getting older. Like, this is not a, like, it's like, I think about when you can get to, because as a small child, right, you don't pay any attention to your parents. They're just there and they're invisible. But when I began to like benchmark, I was like, oh, I knew my parents. I was aware of my parents. I'm now the age that they are. I remember them doing that. And then you think about the things they did and the decisions, and they make a whole lot, it's completely different.
Completely.
Completely different, completely different. Because you're living, even though you're in the same house and you're having the same experience, you're all there for the same holiday. Everybody's having their totally different experience.
Yes.
So really interesting. That's a very interesting way to do it. All right. So in a second, we're going to do the final fun questions. We're going to wrap this up. I want to give you a chance to directly tell people, about the counseling you do and how you want people to follow up with you after the episode.
Okay. Well, my practice is called the Mind Connection and it's in Houston. So you
Okay.
can find that at tmcbrainhealthcenter.com. We are brain health focused and we have a natural health store and an infrared sauna. And we do counseling and microcurrent neurofeedback to help heal the brain. We do all kinds of really amazing natural healing stuff. So that's our work. I also have a website for my books. It's called ourbeautifulrecovery.com. And you can find both of my books there. My book is on Amazon, Goodreads, and Barnes and Noble. And it looks like this.
Finding her and losing her and finding us. There you go.
Yes. And that's where I'm at.
Very nice. All right. Thank you so much for sharing that. All right. Are you ready, Janelle, for the final three questions?
I hope so.
Yeah, no, these are for fun.
Hard.
This has been like a pretty intense discussion. So, but these are just for fun. These are just for fun. Okay. So, what is your favorite meal to eat? For breakfast, or if you're not really a breakfast person, you can choose brunch.
Breakfast is my favorite meal.
Okay, so this is a good question for you. Okay.
Yes, and I almost always get an omelet with the works in it, everything, mostly
Kitchen
vegetables.
sink omelet.
Kitchen sink omelet. Yum.
Yay, there we go. Home fries.
I like I like hash browns better.
Hash browns. Okay. Hash browns are one of those things that I like to order in another restaurant. I don't know if you've ever tried to make hash browns. It's messy to make at home. I like somebody else to make them. It also takes surprisingly a long time. If you grow up ordering hash browns in a restaurant and then you find yourself making them at home, you're like, wow, this is a time commitment. This is going to the breakfast place to order the hash browns. Wow, good hash browns are really, really good. All right. So I'm going to give you three choices. And I want you to choose the one that sounds like the worst option, the one you would ra when you would not want to do. This is not like a serious kind of question, so don't worry. Standing in a slow-moving line, waiting your turn for something. That's option one. Sitting in a traffic jam in a car, running late, or to wherever you're trying to go, or being on hold on the telephone, waiting for an agent to help you. Which of those is your would you not want to do?
Number two.
All right, so the traffic jam.
Yeah.
That's the one.
My problem with it would be I don't have a way to get to the restroom. That would be
Okay.
where I would panic.
No, it's ridiculous. Like it's like there've been a couple times, everybody's been through it. They're stuck in a traffic. You never know it's gonna happen, right? You never know it's gonna happen. And then you're like, oh my gosh, you know. So absolutely, absolutely. All right. So which of these, this is a flip of that. Which of these sounds like fun to you? This is my random list of things you choose. Which of these sounds like fun? Skydiving, scuba diving, mountain climbing, or riding a roller coaster?
Oh gosh. None of the above.
When I made the list, I was like, she's gonna be like, none of these. None.
All of those, maybe scuba diving.
Okay. All right. Very. I should have put something. I needed like an option in there that was like the opposite of like adventure. But that was the list I came up when I did these. Okay. So if you were forced to, it'd be scuba diving. What's something you like to do for fun? Like a fun thing you like to do?
Oh gosh. My fun, I don't have a lot of like typical fun stuff. I do love just people. I like talking to people. I like being around people. I guess that's why I like my job so much, because it has always involves people. I really love spending time with my daughter. I don't know if this is fun. For me, it is. Like, my afternoons on Sunday are spent in my backyard pool, just listening to music and relaxing and soaking up as much sun as I can get. And that's my recharge for the week. And in the winter, I miss that. But I'm pretty chill.
Yeah, so lounging. If I had given you like a lounge on the like lounge on the beach, lounge on a beach chair with like a glass of lemonade, that would have been the option you would have chosen. It would have been a better question. That's it, Janelle Martin. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously. Subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.